This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Real life is scarier than anything we can dream of, and we dream such frightening things. Sci-fi and Scream.
Be afraid.
Be very afraid. On Joy 94.9.
And you are listening to Sci-fi and Scream on Joy 94.9. Thanks to Dave and Jade for Different Strokes. You're listening to Sonia and Kaz, and we have a massive show tonight.
Greetings. So greetings, friends. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing you the full story of what happened. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, faces, my friends, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Can your heart stand the shocking facts of the true story of director and artist Tim Burton? So welcome to Sci-Fi and Scream, tonight's special edition, and it is delving into just, well, first part of a special on Tim Burton and the Tim Burton exhibition that opened today at Acme. We were joined by about 100 other souls this morning at 10 a.m. approximately. It was a media invitation. So it's been quite a long day, and how's it been for you, Kaz?
It's been pretty exhausting. We've been up. Yes. We had our first media call at about 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
So we got in super early to make sure everything was ready. And we've basically been at it all day. And
all day.
There's plenty of Tim Burton.
The day's not over yet.
It's not over yet. The week's not over yet.
No, apparently not.
And of course, in the spirit of Tim Burton, the track we played at the beginning of the show was Suburbia Barber. From the Edward Scissorhands soundtrack.
Great film. And you were taking some good shots there of the Edward Scissorhands costume.
There certainly was.
Now, just looking at Tim Burton, the exhibition, your impressions, Kaz?
I thought it was absolutely fabulous. I'm a big Tim Burton fan, but I'm also a fan of museum exhibitions done well. And this is absolutely beautiful. The Museum of Modern Art first hung this exhibition in New York, of course, and they brought it over to Acme. It's in the same vein as the Pixar 20 Years exhibition that they also brought over, I think it was last year. It's absolutely brilliant. You will never see this much Tim Burton memorabilia in one place ever again, I wouldn't think.
And even he said that it was actually bigger space-wise than
the MoMA.
The MoMA.
Yeah.
And so I found something that pleased me very much. I saw the Angora sweater, which is worn by Johnny Depp in the amazing 1994 film by Tim Burton called Ed Wood. And that was by Colleen Atwood. That was one of the costumes. She's been very influential, and there are many of her works in the exhibition. We'll be talking about Ed Wood, the movie, a little bit later in the show.
We certainly will be. But before we do, we are going to play you a little bit from the media Q&A session that they had today with Tim Burton. Now, we're going to play you some interview. It might be a little bit difficult to hear. There were a lot of camera clickings that got picked up by the recording. It was a very big space as well, as Sonia mentioned, so it was quite a difficult space to record in. But hopefully you'll get a bit of an insight into what makes Tim Burton tick as he speaks to Tony Sweeney, who is actually, I think, is he the head curator?
At Acme. At the moment.
Mm-hmm. I just want to say thank you to everybody here because, like they said, most of the stuff was never meant to really be seen. I felt in very good hands. I've done an amazing job. I also like the lighting. It's much darker than it was at MoMA, which makes me feel a little bit more comfortable. But again, everybody, I want to thank you for making this so well.
It's a pleasure, Tim. Now, we're just going to exchange a few thoughts and some of the questions I know people have been asking that we've got to get at you. It's your second time in Melbourne. I know you haven't been able to look around since your last visit a few years ago, but we will be showing you some of why Melbourne is seen as Australia's creative and cultural capital. But we'll also make sure you find some of the great suburbs too. Not as good as Burbank, but they're pretty close, I assure you. Now, the exhibition in New York, it got quite an extraordinary response, as we've heard. And it got MoMA's third highest attendance ever. How does it feel now that the holy trinity of modern art is Picasso, Matisse, and Burton.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I feel comfortable about, I mean, for me, what was made me feel comfortable is that it wasn't presenting me as like either a great artist or filmmaker. It's just something as a process, and I felt very, very comfortable in what they told me about New York was that people that wouldn't ordinarily go to a museum came to the show, which that made me feel very, very, you know, great. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, because I didn't grow up in a museum culture. You know, I went to the Hollywood Wax Museum. It's probably the only mm-hmm. museum I really went to. So I can't really call that a museum. But that's what I love about this place, too. When you showed me around yesterday, the sort of interactive nature of things, it's just is much more inviting and exciting, and that's why I'm very happy to, you know, be here. You really, you know, present things in a way that just makes it more, you know, it's not so standoffish as the sort of museum experience. It's sort of much more draws you in, which I really, really appreciate.
Thanks, Tim. You were surprised when they were approached by Ron and the MoMA team about doing a career retrospective, weren't you? Were you very reluctant, or did it grab you straight away?
Yeah, I mean, I you know, I didn't realize I saved so much stuff, because I never really look at it. I sort of stuff in drawers, and Ron and Jenny just kind of did an archaeological dig, and, you know, they found my original rejection slips from Disney and all sorts of things, which I didn't even know I had or kept, so... You know, I learned a lot about myself that I wouldn't have ordinarily, because I would have never ever looked at it again. So, you know, they really did a lot of work and digging around to find a lot of this stuff.
As good fun as making a film?
Yeah, it's strange. You know, it's like having your dirty laundry hanging on the walls a bit in some ways. But, like I said, with all of you and the way you presented it and stuff, I feel really, really... comfortable and in good hands.
That's great. And you like the way the exhibition is presented here? We're particularly pleased with the creatures and so on you've taken out on the streets of Melbourne.
Yeah, it's great. It's really, really beautiful. And it's, again, it's a different space than MoMA in New York, obviously. Mm-hmm. And, it's a bigger space here, but it still feels intimate. It still, you know, has the chaos of my mind in a way. It's great, because it's the same, some of the same material, but different. And it, for me, it really, seeing this for the first time, really fits this space really, really nicely. And it's, you know, it's got a good finish, it's got a good flow to it. It's very nice.
Well, I've got to say, our space has never looked better than what with your work's gracing it. Right. Now, look, the shows are really quite personal and very generous insight into your filmmaking. You say it's about your dirty laundry, and I mean, it really is sort of an entire career going back to your youngest period, and it goes right into your imagination. You use a wide range of media and inspirations, obviously, but you've said that drawing is your thought process. What is it about drawing that makes it such an important form for you?
Well, early on in my life, I didn't really speak, so I, you know, as like an animator at Disney, I didn't speak very much, and so I always used drawing as a way to communicate, you know, and also explore my own, you know, I felt much more comfortable doing a sketch and having that have more meaning to me than sort of my intellectual mind, and so it's always been, in certain projects, a way of like thinking that, well, that's more meaningful and powerful for me coming from an image, and rather than writing a lot, sometimes if I go someplace or whatever, a little sketch or doodle or drawing for me, you know, is my, you know, kind of like my journal.
It sort of gets your brain straight onto that.
Yeah, right? It comes out more from the subconscious, and I feel much more sort of comfortable, and that comes from a stronger place for me.
There's also quite a lot of verbal wordplay, though, in what you do. You see on the walls here a number of your early limericks and so on. You seem to like wordplay a lot.
Well, yeah, my early, you know, Dr. Seuss was an early strong influence, and there's something about the rhythmic nature of his words, and it kind of, again, not talking a lot, for me, it was a way of, you know, kind of communicating simply, and, you know, so he was quite a strong influence on that.
And you're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9 with Sonia and Kaz, and we are talking Tim Burton.
Everything Tim Burton. And just some little facts and a little bit of trivia and bits and pieces about the man himself. The stuff on Tim. His real name is Timothy William Burton. Date of birth, 25th of August 1958 in Burbank, California. So he's a very Los Angelian, Hollywood sort of person.
It's Burbank. Huge. I didn't realise what a big influence it was on his work until I saw the exhibition.
And among his cinematic influences are the Italian maestro of horror Mario Bava, Vincent Price, Roger Corman, and Barbara Steele, whom he homaged in Sleepy Hollow, made back in 1999. So Italian director Mario Bava is a big, big, big fan. His former partner, Lisa Marie, is also somebody that was very influential on his actual career. And believe it or not, David Cronenberg. Now, from what I've discovered, now, he has made 7 films to date with Johnny Depp, Edward Scissorhands in 1990, Ed Wood in 1994, Sleepy Hollow in 1999, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory in 2005, Corpse Bride, well, it was Johnny's voice in 2005 as well, Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street in 2007, and of course Alice in Wonderland in 2010. Now, at the end of Beetlejuice in 1988, Beetlejuice metamorphosizes into a bizarre creature with a merry-go-round head. On top of that merry-go-round is a smiling skull which became Jack Skellington in The Nightmare Before Christmas, which came out in 1993. So there is a great, always a continuum in his films, and you can see that certainly in the exhibition. What else? Like I said, he credits his former fiancée, Lisa Marie, as his muse, and she's often been in a number of his projects, including Ed Wood, Mars Attacks, which came out in 1986, Sleepy Hollow, The World of Stain Boy, which I haven't seen, actually. Have you seen that
one? No, it's an internet-based sort of serial, and I haven't seen it either, to be honest.
Planet of the Apes, in 2001, not known as one of his best. But she has appeared in those, and she's also been the inspiration for Sally from Nightmare Before Christmas in 1993. Currently, he's in a relationship since 2001 with actress Helena Bonham Carter, who, of course, has been in several of his films. He has 2 children to her. They have 2 children together, Billy Ray and a little girl as well, which I don't have the name for. He's a big Bollywood fan, apparently, and wherever he goes, he carries a pocket-sized sketchbook and a small watercolour kit, in case he gets inspired.
And you can see that because there's a part of the exhibition where you can see that he's scribbled an illustration on a hotel notepad.
Okay, I missed that one.
And it's really fabulous. He kind of just seems to work. Whenever an idea comes to him, he'll jot it down. Mm. So that's Tim Burton. We played the first part of the media Q&A today. It was a little bit hard to hear. There was a lot of camera snapping going on in the background. But you could hear a little bit about what it is that sort of makes Tim Burton, that was his inspiration, and he mentioned Dr. Seuss and sort of the lyrical quality of those sorts of things. And we've got a few SMSs in.
We have. Hi, Sonia and Kaz. Our favourite Tim Burton film is The Corpse Bride, because we love animation and death. A delicious conflict. Indeed it is. All the best. Thank you, Andy and Gav. And they've sent in their membership numbers, so they will go into the draw for one of those prizes. And we have another person here, Antoine. His favourite Tim Burton film is Sleepy Hollow because he says, I like historical horror and I have a thing for Headless Horsemen.
I have to say that I agree with Andy and Gav. I really love Corpse Bride.
Fabulous. Death and Conflict.
It's always a good one. Conflicting film. It's one of those ones that you'd play for a younger audience, but an older audience will definitely take something from it.
It's quite nightmarish, but in a fun way.
It definitely is. Mm. You're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream. We're Sonia and Kaz, and we are talking all things Tim Burton this week. And that was the Beetlejuice animated TV series theme by Danny Elfman. And we've put that on because I'm going to talk a little bit about Beetlejuice, which is probably my favourite Tim Burton film.
It's fantastic.
It's definitely up there. It was released in 1998, and it was Tim Burton's second feature after Pee-wee's Big Adventure, also a big favourite in my family, I have to say. And at the Acme exhibition, you can actually see some of Burton's production notes about the film. And he describes the story as follows. 2 nice, old-fashioned people die, and when an awful family move in, they try to get rid of them. Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis play Adam and Barbara Maitland, and they are the nice, old-fashioned married couple who are killed in a car accident and return to their home as ghosts. Now, they were in the process of renovating their home. It's a lovely old building set away from the main town when they die. Before their bodies are cold in the grave, however, the home has been sold to the awful Dietz family. Charles Dietz, played very affably by Jeffrey Jones, is a contractor who has moved his family to the country after suffering from a nervous breakdown. Now, this move does not go over well with his wife Delia, who is played absolutely wonderfully by Catherine O'Hara. And Delia is an aspiring sculptor, and she just longs to return to that New York art scene. Charles's daughter and Delia's stepdaughter is an aspiring emo, Lydia Dietz, played by Winona Ryder. Now, the Dietz family have also brought along with them Otho, who is played by the absolutely fabulous Glenn Shaddix. And Otho is a snobbish interior designer who, along with Delia, is dying to gut this house and remodel it completely. Unsurprisingly, this does not go down well with the deceased Maitlands, who decide to use their newfound status as ghosts to drive the Dietz family from their home. In their attempts, they enlist the help of Beetlejuice, who is a bio-exorcist, with dangerous and hilarious consequences. And of course, as we all know, Michael Keaton plays that title character. Now, the character of Beetlejuice has been described variously as a pervert, a psycho, and grotesque. But most importantly, he is goddamn funny. In one of his ramblings, he describes living through the Black Plague and having a pretty good time doing it. He's also seen The Exorcist about 167 times, and it keeps getting funnier every single time he sees it. Great line delivered so well by Michael Keaton. Keaton has actually mentioned in a few interviews that Beetlejuice is one of his favourite characters, and you can totally see why. I mean, despite being covered in a barrow full of makeup, Keaton just shines through and he draws you in to this utterly detestable character. Oddly enough, Tim Burton originally wanted Sammy Davis Jr., who was a childhood favourite of his, to play the role of Beetlejuice, but the studio basically vetoed the idea almost immediately. Beetlejuice is so classless and gross that you just can't imagine the consummate rat packer anywhere near the role. But Keaton just kills it. Beetlejuice was one of the biggest comedies of the sort of late 80s, early 90s. I remember watching it as a young'un. Look, again and again, my sisters, my brother and I would sit down and watch it with a mixture of delight and fear. Interestingly, Michael McDowell's original script for Beetlejuice is far less comedic and much more violent. For example, instead of possessing the Dietzes and forcing them to dance during the dinner scene, in the original script, the Maitlands cause a vine-patterned carpet to come to life and attack the Dietzes by tangling them to their chairs, which is slightly more violent than what happens in the film. The character of Beetlejuice, as envisioned by McDowell, was a winged demon who takes on the form of a short Middle Eastern man who is intent on killing the Dietzes instead of just scaring them. McDowell's script also featured a second Dietz child, 9-year-old Kathy, who in that script was the only person to see the Maitlands and is basically the subject of Beetlejuice's kind of homicidal wrath in the climax of the film or the original script, during which he mutilates her while in the form of a rabid squirrel before revealing his true form. Yeah, it doesn't sound quite as funny as the film that they ended up with. The film was to have concluded with the Maitlands, the Dietzes and Otho conducting an exorcism ritual that destroys Beetlejuice, and the Maitlands transform into miniature versions of themselves and move into Adam's model of their home. It's slightly different. Now, Warren Scarron came in and rewrote the script and drastically shifted the tone. He kind of indicated the graphic nature of the Maitlands' deaths rather than sort of showing it on screen. And he depicted the afterlife as something of this complex bureaucracy, and the Maitlands have to struggle to understand this afterlife with their copy of The Handbook for the Recently Deceased. Now, Scarron's first draft retained some of the more sinister characteristics of Beetlejuice, but he basically toned the character down to make him a bit more of a pervert rather than, you know, a sort of homicidal maniac. The result is that the film is far more comedy than horror. The production notes from the Burton exhibition also have this note. This has to be a human story with earth-shattering consequences, life, death, greed. And that's really the way that the film turns out. The Maitlands are a nice couple, but they lead a kind of mundane existence, which appears quite creepy itself to the incoming Dietz family. But to the Maitlands, the Dietzes are the ones who seem odd. Throughout the film, attitudes to life and death change or are shifted. Lydia, who is a goth teen character, thinks that the other side has to be better than what she has, and the Maitlands want nothing more than their boring old life back. And Delia and Otho kind of think it's harmless enough to dabble in between. Beetlejuice is trapped in a kind of limbo, ejected from the establishment in the afterlife, and longing to wreak havoc on the living. Beetlejuice's creator, Michael McDowell, who happened to be openly gay, sadly passed away in 1999, so never got to see that his film is still remembered and memorialised in this day. McDowell wrote horror novels for a living, and he didn't really consider his work classic in any sense. He once said that he never wrote for the ages. However, Beetlejuice is a film that continues to be enjoyed by new generations all over the world. It's odd and original, and it really deserves a place among comedy classics. I can't hear Harry Belafonte without thinking of this film. As recently as this year, Michael Keaton and Gina Davis expressed interest in a sequel, with Keaton saying that he would do it in a heartbeat. So it seems like the love for a Beetlejuice sequel might still be there, but I don't know how good an idea it would be.
And would Tim Burton want to do it?
Yes, exactly. Would he want to do it?
Because what was interesting during the press conference or the media conference is he did mention that there were, you know, he was asked a question basically, was he going to be doing a Dark Shadows based on the popular television series about a vampire soap opera basically made in the 60s, and he neither confirmed nor denied it. Wasn't that right? It was kind of weird because the press had been talking about it for a number of months and he just shook his head.
Yeah, he really did. He didn't want to commit to saying anything. And he really didn't commit to any other project. He kind of said he'll just wait to see what comes along. He also made an interesting point, and you'll hear it a bit later in the interview, that often deadlines or release dates are given for films before a script
is even written.
Has even been written.
Yeah.
Which is bizarre. Ridiculous when you think about it.
True.
So he's obviously got a really good idea of what it takes to build a film. From the ground up.
Definitely.
So that was Beetlejuice. My impressions, it was a big film from my childhood. We're going to play a couple of messages, and then what we're going to do is play you the second part of the Tim Burton media Q&A that Sonia and I attended today. Again, you'll have to forgive the quality. It was quite a big space, and it was a little bit echoey at times, and there's a lot of camera clicks from all the snappers who were there. But hopefully you'll be able to get a good sense of what Tim Burton thinks of his work and what he thinks of this exhibition.
Now, the visual style is rightly famous, but I find, looking around here, it's your observation of people and places is just as much what drives the ideas and humour. Johnny Depp, I believe, has said that you can capture the entire essence of a character in one quick pen sketch and suddenly open out for actors what it's all about. Where did that sort of observation and free play of imagination come from?
Well, I guess it was sort of feeling outside of society. You kind of... You're not feeling in there, you're kind of looking at things. So I always felt much more, I'd go sit in like shopping malls and do sketches and things, or just drawings and look at people. And I think a lot of it has to do with the feeling of not, feeling a part of society. So you feel much more observational towards things. So I don't know, perhaps that's sort of where it kind of comes from.
You've worked with an extraordinary group of close and very long-standing collaborators, among them obviously greats like Johnny Depp, composer Danny Elfman, costume designer Colleen Atwood, and of course Helena Bonham Carter. What is it about those groups that sort of seem to knit together so successfully and help realise your vision?
Well, I like working with people. It's fun to work with people that you've worked with before because you bounce, it's a collaborative process for them, so obviously... you get things from other people. I like working with actors and seeing, for instance, with John, to see him play different characters and do different things. And, it's nice to work with new people and mix it up, but there is something sort of fascinating about seeing somebody transform each time into something different. And, that's something I learned early on. After being kind of a loner, making films, you become like this weird family and part of the joy of making a film is working with other artists and bouncing off of each other that way and, learning from them and gaining from them. And, that's the fun of the filmmaking process.
You said yesterday, though, you still see the characters and you pick the right actor for the character rather than starting from the actors, don't you?
Yeah, I think it's you can always be surprised by anything. There may be an actor that you don't particularly like or feel surprised, but for the right character, they can sort of blow your mind and all of a sudden be your favorite actor. So I always like to try to keep open to
that experience and, you know, coming from a character and never do anything, whether like, oh, I think this is going to be successful or that actor. You try to start it from the sort of seed of it, whatever the project is, and then go from there.
Hmm. Okay, you've had quite a remarkable career. The cult successes like Beetlejuice to the amazing success of Alice in Wonderland, it's about the fifth highest grossing of all time. You must now be becoming conscious of the pressure to deliver really quite huge box office. Does it sort of affect that very individualistic vision you've always had in your films?
No, because it's always a struggle to make a film. You know, I realized early on, you know, when you make a successful film, you think, oh, well, you know, then you have the opportunity to do whatever you want to do. And I remember after doing Batman, I thought, well, that was a success. But then after that, trying to get Edward Scissorhands done was very difficult. Nobody wanted to do that, and you know, nobody wanted to do Ed Wood. I have that even now. You know, so it's a process that you know, always kind of keeps you slightly humble. You know, it's never kind of a blank check and never an open book that way. It's always a struggle to get a film made, but you know, that's what also makes it, you know, feel like you achieve something, yeah, is to go through that kind of trauma.
Okay. So, finally, what's next? We know you're working on Frank and Weenie, and there's some of the early models in there, and I gather there might be a feature film version of the television series Dark Shadows. After the Burton Down Under film, what's after that?
No, there's this horrifying trend in Hollywood where they have a release date before you have a script, you know, and then trying to get, you know, I've done that, been there before, and I'm not going to do that again. So I really don't have a project next until whatever the next, you know, I get a good script on something, and then, you know, then you go for it. Because you spend so long on something, a couple of years, you know, you want to make sure you feel passionate about it. So, yeah, I'm still recovering from the Cannes Film Festival and this. So, you know, I'm just focusing on this, which is very, really exciting.
Yeah, you had a good time at Cannes looking at catching up on films.
Yeah, no, it's interesting to see what's going on in the world. You know, and it's, it was exciting. And this, you know, my focus has been on this.
And I think you created a surprise again for us, Tim, in the film you picked as the winner there. It was a very individual film.
Yeah, no, it's funny, but I enjoy it because, you know, this world is so fast-paced and rapid and fire and, you know, so quick. It was a very sort of contemplative, quiet film, which, you know, I thought was just a nice antidote to everything else that's happening in the world. Mm.
Well, we're looking forward, after you've got your energies back, for the next film, whatever it is, you know, it's going to be fantastic. Thanks for coming to Melbourne. We hope it's the first of many visits. And there is a very special friendship for you down
there.
Thank
you very much. We really appreciate you having me.
Thank you.
Sci-Fi and Scream with Sonia and Kaz. And tonight we've been doing a bit of a special on the Tim Burton, the exhibition and the director and the man. And that was Indian Love Called, the piece of music before the break, with Slim Whitman. Now that's from Mars Attacks. And they did have some Mars Attacks props and pictures there, which were quite amazing.
They were absolutely fabulous. Mars Attacks is a very funny film, and the props that they brought are very appropriate.
There were heads,
and there was a Martian anatomy chart, which is fantastic. Now, before that, we played a little bit from the media Q&A session between Tim Burton and Tony Sweeney from ACME, but we understand that it may not have come through very well on the radio, so we
apologize
for that. We're going to put that through in the podcast, so hopefully you'll be able to hear that a little more clearly. It was a great and interesting insight into the mind of a great director who directed such films as Ed Wood.
That's right.
Ed Wood is your favourite Tim Burton
film. That is
film.
My favourite. Now, this is a Tim Burton film that was produced with a woman, Denise Donovi. Now, it starred Johnny Depp, of course, Martin Landau, Sarah Jessica Parker, Patricia Arquette, Jeffrey Jones, Judy Spradling, Vincent D'Onofrio, Bill Murray, who was wonderful in that, and Tim Burton's ex, Lisa Marie, also known as Lisa Marie Smith. Also had Juliet Landau, and that is Martin Landau's daughter, and George the Animal Steele. Production design was fabulous, and that was by Tom Duffield. Now, it's a biopic of the life and work of the legendary worst director of all time called Edward D. Wood Jr., concentrating on the best-known period of his life in the 1950s, when he made films like Glen or Glenda in 1953, Bride of the Monster in 1955, and, of course, the notorious and wonderfully bad Plan 9 from Outer Space in 1959. It also focuses on his transvestism and his touching friendship with the late and the great and once wonderful vampire star, none other than Bela Lugosi. Now, the opening titles of the film start with the old Hollywood sign in a chiaroscuro matte black and white, almost silver steel black and white, with UFOs, saucer shape, flying over the horizon line. And then we see a theatre, a play in progress, one of Ed Wood's attempts at doing drama on stage. It's a total flop. The reviews are a disaster. But Ed Wood Jr., a transvestite, decides that he is going to keep on going. He's going to keep on making films the way he wants to make films. And it's the 1950s, so obviously it's a lot cheaper to make films back then. He's a props man. He works behind the scenes on many Hollywood films as well. And he likes to wear women's clothing, but he's a straight man. He says, "I love women. Wearing their clothes makes me feel closer to them." In World War II, apparently, according to legend, he wore women's underwear underneath his uniform, and he was more worried about being caught behind him in enemy lines alive wearing women's knickers than he was being killed. Now, it's a fantastic film. It's one of my favourites, and it's the first and only Burton film to date that doesn't have the music mastery of Danny Elfman. The music's actually done by Howard Shaw, and it's awesome. There's a lot of theremins in there and very old-school sounds from the 50s, very influential. Released in 1994, the biopic with a difference, and it's Burton doing the genre of biopic in a very unique way. Well, I think so. It's in black and white, as I mentioned, and it's a homage and a salute to the man, a very flawed man, the director Edward Wood Jr. It portrays a man who's on a personal mission, a mission of great zeal, a mission of madness, and that's to make movies the way he sees fit, which is as cheap as possible, as quick as possible, and really with the worst possible plots you can imagine. Now, Tim Burton adores this man. It's pretty obvious. It shows in the film and in great detail. The loving camera work. It's one of the few films that I've ever viewed that actually, even though it's in black and white, it has a lot of warmth and glowingness to it that makes it not noir, although the style is based on late 1940s noir, but it's not a thriller either. It's a comedy, it's a love story, and it's a love story about a director, Tim Burton, expressing his love for an eccentric filmmaker from the era when films were pretty bad or pretty wonderful. And I think, obviously, Ed Wood is in the pretty bad, the former part. It's a very romantic film, and the reality of the actual person is not really looked at deeply. He was a troubled and addicted personality. But who cares when you've got a film that looks as good and as wonderful as this? And after all is said and done, it's masterful Burton, I believe. It wasn't a great box office success, not at all, but it earned an Oscar for the wonderful Martin Landau, who displayed great technique doing Bela Lugosi so well. Now, the real Ed Wood had a terrible background, basically. He ended up doing soft porn, bad porn, basically, and apart from the sad decline of his life with alcoholism, his demise was much more difficult than it shows in the film. So the film only goes up to 1959. Now, Plan 9 from Outer Space is Ed Wood's greatest achievement. It's the worst film ever in history, as it's been voted, but some say it is his godfather, and Bride of the Monster is Ed Wood's Godfather Part 2. So he died on December of 10th, 1978. He was found drinking as football played on television. They carried his body out of the house in garbage bags. Pretty sad end to such an influential man. Now, that's Ed Wood. Just a little bit on the film. Now, in order to appreciate the film Ed Wood, I think it's important to remember that directors like Edward Wood Jr., that's a mouthful, may not have been the greatest directors, but it's almost like 20, 30 years later, someone like Tim Burton comes along and, you know, celebrates people like that, the eccentrics.
Well, that's right. And some people would call Tim Burton an eccentric director. He has his detractors as well.
Mm.
People who think that perhaps an exhibition for a filmmaker like
Tim Burton. I always called him Ted Burton because I'm stuck on the Ed Wood thing.
It's hard. Ed Wood, Wood Jr.
Ed Wood Jr., Tim Burton.
Yeah.
Some would say that it's a little excessive. However, I think it's really important to get along to the exhibition
and
just see what it is to be an organic kind of filmmaker, someone who thinks of their, you know, they imagine the ideas from, you know, a small picture in their head to an incredible vision on film. And that was someone like Ed Wood, I think Tim Burton. And it's, I like the fact that you mentioned that even though it's in black and white, it's got this kind of warmth to it, because
it's
that's the impression I get as well.
Yeah, I get warm, it's fuzzy feelings
he's
about
beautiful.
It.
Beautiful. Like, I know Johnny Depp's a beautiful man, but he gives him this real beauty and kind of...
Even when he
pops
his dentures out.
I
lost those pearlies and WW2.
I just think it's a really friendly, warm film. You do get genuine affection for this character.
Yeah.
We are talking about Tim Burton on Sci-Fi and Screen. We're talking about Tim Burton this week and next week because there's just so
much
to cover. We have received another SMS. Hillary has SMS'd Edward Scissorhands is her favourite because at that time it was the most creative, clever and touching film that she'd seen, and is a very touching film, Edward Scissorhands. And also slightly creepy, that vision of suburbia. We're going to go to a track and we'll be back with more Tim Burton talk. Yes, it's Sci-Fi and Squeam and you're listening to Joy 94.9. I'm Kaz. Sonia's across
I'm
the
here.
Desk from me. We've been talking Tim Burton all this hour and we are going to talk about him all next week's show as well because there's just too much to get through.
There's not enough time. So we will play the Jenny Hay interview we had. Jenny from New York, from MoMA. And we'll also be talking to, there's an interview of me talking to Roberta Chiabatta from ACME, who's doing the Monsters, Ghouls and Melancholy Misfits, which is a tribute to Tim Burton and his influences. Or should I say, the influences on him.
Yes.
The films he would have approved of.
Absolutely.
Or enjoyed.
And I think that it might be prudent to talk about things that Tim Burton might do in the future. Now, Tim's already done a remake with Alice in Wonderland. He also did Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Mm. And rumours have occasionally surfaced that Tim Burton will take on a remake of the Frank L. Baum story, The Wizard of Oz. Now, a website called ImagineCasting.com has Burton as top choice for director, with Anne Hathaway, who played the White Queen in Alice, as Dorothy.
Mm-hmm.
Christopher Walken would play the Wizard.
Mm-hmm.
Will Ferrell would play the Cowardly Lion. Sigh. Matthew Broderick, the Tin Man. Meryl Streep would play Glinda, the Good Witch.
I've seen this movie.
I think that's an inspired choice,
I've
Meryl
seen
Streep.
This movie.
Have you?
I'm sure I've seen it already.
Well, it sounds like something that should be put together. But hang on a minute. What about the Burton stalwarts, Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter?
They can play Brabham's sister.
Well, not quite. Of course, Helena would play the Wicked Witch of the East and Johnny would play
Toto.
The Scarecrow.
Okay.
Which is not a huge departure from his role in Alice in Wonderland. Another thing that's been going around the traps is a Tim Burton remake of Weekend at Bernie's. Now, this has become quite a favourite on the internet. A very funny fan video has been posted online and received a number of hits. Now, Johnny Depp would star as the deceased titular character, really stretching those acting chops of his. And instead of just being propped up in a chair, he can be grotesquely puppeteered on tangled green string to a jaunty tune by Danny Elfman.
Or Tom Jones.
Or Tom Jones, which we just played off the Mars Attacks
And that appears
soundtrack.
Twice. In Tim Burton Attacks. Films, Mars Attacks played it and Edward Scissorhands.
Oh, it does too.
It was the first time it appeared.
I love Tom Jones. Another remake that some people are mentioning could be Labyrinth. Now, fandom is torn in two by this one. Some folk are mighty excited by the idea that Tim Burton would remake this 1986 classic that was originally directed by Jim Henson. Others, possibly like me, are horrified at the idea of anyone laying a finger on this much-loved story. Now, of course, a young ingenue would play Sarah, but I think we all know who would take on the role of the Goblin King, Jareth. Yep, Helena Bonham Carter. No, it would be Johnny Depp, of course, but is he man enough to fill David Bowie's codpiece? Now, a remake of sorts, which Tim Burton's name has already been drawn to, is Maleficent, which is the Sleeping Beauty remake from the Evil Queen's point of view. Now, this is a remake that might actually happen, unlike Weekend at Bernie's. Tim Burton's name's been associated with this project for a while. Now, Maleficent was the main antagonist in the 1959 adaptation of Sleeping Beauty, who curses Princess Aurora to prick her finger and die. Now, I can definitely see Helena in this role, part Red Queen, part Bellatrix Lestrange, and Johnny Depp with long flowing blonde hair as Princess Aurora, because he's got to be in there somewhere. Do you have any films you'd like to see Tim Burton remake, or perhaps not remake?
The Elephant Man, actually, because that's in the retrospective, but in the Monsters, Ghouls and Melancholy Misfits at Acme. Yeah, The Elephant Man. David Lynch did that originally, but I think it could be more, I hate to say it, but humorous.
You think it could be more humorous retelling of the horrible
story?
Yeah,
it needs a bit more humour in that one. It's not so funny.
Have a bit of a laugh at yourself,
have
Elephant
a laugh.
Man. Jeez. All
right.
It's not
get
that
over
bad.
It. Now we have a winner for the draw. We have a winner for the Monsters, Ghouls and Melancholy Misfits, and that is Hillary. Thank you so much, Hillary, and we'll be in touch with you about that one. That's a double pass. And we have another winner, and that is Antoine. Antoine, you have won a double pass to the Tim Burton exhibition at Acme, so we'll be in touch with you over that. And thank you for sending those messages in and your membership numbers. So remember, you can only win prizes on Joy 94.9 if you're a member.
Yes, that's a very stern warning there from Sonia. Join up. If you didn't join up during Radiothon, join up now.
Right. Do we have time for news?
We have a minute or two for news.
Oh, okay.
Top
right.
stories.
Top story is first up news. Well, this is actually from the 19th of June. It's now not the 19th. It's been 5 years in the making, and now Universal Orlando Resort has celebrated the grand opening of the Wizarding World of Harry Potter.
Yay!
Now, the event was attended by Harry Potter, the author and creator J.K. Rowling, and the cast of the films, including Harry Potter himself, Daniel Radcliffe, Rupert Grint, and Michael Gambon. Bonnie Wright was there, James Phelps and Oliver Phelps, Warwick Davis and Matthew Lewis. The legendary composer John Williams, who wrote the theme for the film, was also in attendance, and he conducted the Orlando Philharmonic Orchestra, performing the film's theme. It must have been quite an event. Next up, Universal Pictures has unleashed a new international trailer for the Edgar Wright, or Shaun of the Dead, adaptation of Brian Lee O'Malley's comic book series Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. The film stars Michael Cera, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Satya Barber, Chris Evans, Brandon Routh, Kieran Culkin, wonder who he's related to, Mae Whitman, and the wonderful Jason Schwartzman, one of my favourites.
A hard name to say, Jason Schwartzman.
Yeah, it is. I'm glad his name's not Sean Schwartzman. It will open in theatres August the 13th in the UK. No date is set as yet for its opening date here in Australia.
So that's
just a little bit of news.
Just a little bit of news for you. So we've been talking all things Tim Burton. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Again, we apologise if you couldn't hear that Tim Burton, Tony Sweeney Q&A session, but we will have that up on the internet for you.
That's right. That's the end of our show tonight. And well, they said it couldn't be done, but I think we proved them wrong. Now, we looked at Tim Burton, the exhibition, and next week, like I said, we'll be catching up on some of those interviews. And as the mighty Criswell says in Ed Wood, remember, my friends, future events such as these will affect you in the future. Up next, we have The Frequency, with the last of the Taste of Radio students or graduates.
That's right, and it's going to be a tribute to Adam Stobbs, who was much loved and is much missed here at Joy.
On Joy 94.9.
Out. Proud. Loud. Joy. 94.9.
Sci-Fi and Scream was synthesized and squashed into shape by Sonia, Albert and Kaz. For more information, visit our Facebook page, Sci-Fi and Scream, or check out joy.org.au.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.